The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Doers, mowing season is here. With Spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot. Right now, you can get gas like power with the Ryobi 40-volt push mower for just $329. With a runtime of nearly an hour, it's the perfect mower to tackle your half-acre lawn without a trip to the gas station. Just push and mow. Your grass won't wait, so buy it online and pick it up in-store to get out there sooner. Get gas like power this spring with the Ryobi 40-volt push mower, just $329 during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Welcome to A Good Football Show's Week 14 Recap Pod. My name is Pat Crane, and in just a few moments here, I'll be joined by the NBC Sports Edge team that covered Week 14 for us. We're going to be able to dive into all of the additional context beyond the box score for these games, help you understand all of the little nitty-gritty type of stuff, which guys picked up injuries this week, what the backfield rotations were, some changing situations, that type of stuff. And let's go ahead and get to the games. The Browns defeated the Ravens 24-22 in a game marked by injuries. Lamar Jackson left the game early with an ankle injury, and Kareem Hunt also left the game early with an ankle injury. Denny Carter, how did Tyler Huntley look filling in for Lamar Jackson here?
Yeah, Huntley was more than a game manager in this one, which is more than we can say about the last time he stepped in for Lamar. He was 27 of 38 through the air for 270 yards and a touchdown. He also rushed for 45 yards on six attempts. Of course, he had two devastating fumbles, one of which just set the Ravens back to the point of no return, pretty much, despite their furious last-minute comeback against the Browns. I think game script had a lot to do with that. I don't think the Ravens really want Tyler Huntley dropping back 38 times and throwing for 270, but it was encouraging going forward, especially if Lamar is out, next week or over the long term. I mean, Lamar was carted off in this one, so it could be a significant ankle sprain. It is good to know that Huntley can hit those downfield passes. He hit a couple to Rashad Bateman. He continually hit Mark Andrews over the middle. But again, a lot of this was game script driven.
Yeah, interesting that Andrews and Bateman both went over 100 yards here. Andrews caught all 11 of his targets, had 115 yards and a touchdown. Bateman had 103 yards, having seven receptions on eight targets. Marquise Brown a little quieter. He went 5 for 41 on eight targets, but definitely seems to have a strong connection with Andrews. And if I recall, he seemed to have a pretty strong connection with him in the one game that he started earlier this year as well.
That's right. He looked time and again, Huntley looked to Bateman and Andrews, not as much Marquise Brown as you might have thought. But Marquise Brown continues to operate as kind of an extension of the running game, catching those passes at or near the line of scrimmage, whereas Bateman was operating a little more downfield here. I know that Sammy Watkins was a little banged up in this one, so that may have expanded Bateman's role. I mean, remember last week we were talking about Bateman being unplayable after a one target, zero reception performance. So it's really up and down with Bateman. But this, I guess this was encouraging. I don't want to speak too soon though.
He looked really good from what I saw. He looked like a professional, like a very good wide receiver to me. What was your take there?
Yeah. He caught a 36 yard pass over his shoulder on the sideline, like a gorgeous pass from Huntley, honestly, and an even better catch from Bateman. Yeah. He looked the part for sure. And you just hope that the Ravens think the same thing, that they agree and that they, you know, have Bateman in a more prominent role going forward.
Yeah. On the Browns side, I believe we had an injury scare here with Baker Mayfield. Is that right?
Yeah. You know, I would, if Baker Mayfield were on with us right now and we would say injury scare, he would laugh probably in our faces because he did not believe that he was concussed after a hard hit by a Ravens defender. But somebody did. Somebody on the sideline or watching from the box believed that he needed to go into the protocol, the concussion protocol. So he went into the blue tent. He was furious about it. He comes out a minute later, just, you know, irritated, and comes back in after missing two plays. So, you know, apparently he was okay. It just so happens that his second half play had really dropped off at that point from a decent first half, you know, against a pass funnel Ravens defense. He threw a touchdown to Jarvis Landry over the middle, and Landry took one in on a catch and run, and then he hit Austin Hooper on a 1 or 2 yard touchdown early on. From there, the Browns got predictably very conservative, not sure what to do while up multiple scores, and let the Ravens, you know, get back into the game.
Yeah, I guess not too much practice there. What about Donovan Peoples-Jones, Austin Hooper? Both of them had decent games. Hooper got in the end zone. Peoples-Jones led the team with 90 receiving yards.
Yeah, you know, we mentioned on a good football show this week, I forget which day it was, but we mentioned that no team targets the tight end more than the Browns. So with David Njoku out with COVID and with Harrison Bryant out with an ankle, that left Austin Hooper to absorb a lot of those routes and targets. And he came through as much as Austin Hooper can possibly come through, 30 yards and a touchdown on 5 catches. He saw 7 targets. So we will take it. I'm happy about that.
That's an Austin Hooper spike week.
That's a spike. Peoples-Jones, 7 targets, which was 1 short of the team lead. Landry led the team with 8. He caught 5 for 90. His big play came in the first quarter on a 34-yard reception. He also had a near long-ish touchdown from Mayfield later on in the game. I'm curious to see his air yards in this one. I would think that they're pretty strong again. He's clearly out there as like a full-time member of this offense.
Nice. And then in the backfield, when did Kareem Hunt get hurt, and what were your thoughts on the backfield here? I'll just note the stats. Chubb had 17 carries for 59 yards. D'Ernest Johnson had 4 for 22. Hunt only had 2 for 5. And then D'Ernest Johnson had 1 reception for 7 yards. Hunt 2 for 13. Chubb 3 for 6.
Yeah. So D'Ernest Johnson got involved, and again, like he always does, looked pretty good. He had ripped off a 13 yard run at one point on one of his 4 carries. This was after Kareem Hunt went down with the ankle around halftime, just before halftime, and seemed to be in significant pain, went to the blue injury tent, and then was helped back to the locker room. I was trying my best to keep track of where he was. He was on the sideline, back on the sideline at some point, but I don't think he re-entered the game, and they continued to just rotate with Johnson and Chubb.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. Danny Carter, thanks so much.
Thanks.
The Seahawks defeated the Texans 33-13 in what was a career rushing day for Rashad Penny. Chris Allen, the Seahawks ground game finally got rolling here.
Yeah, and I think that was one of the better parts to see out of that offense. Well, of course, I know folks were probably happy to see Russell Wilson at least be a bit more efficient in the passing game. But yeah, to see both elements of the Seattle's offense really getting back on track, I think was really great to see. I mean, I know that this is not the way to really analyze like Penny's performance, but outside of the two longer runs that he had, I mean, he did have the 47-yard house call towards the end of the game, a 32-yard touchdown in the first half as well. Outside of that, I mean, more of a pedestrian day, like on the ground, but overall, it's good to see Penny out there, one, making it through an entire game without getting injured or being having to go off into the medical tent and us really not seeing him for the rest of the game, but two, also seeing that athleticism that we had really thought that he was capable of doing, like when he came out of college. So like, all those pieces put together, I mean, add that to Russell Wilson essentially being Russell Wilson and having those, you know, getting blitzed or getting pressured, scrambling out of pressure and being able to hit either of his receivers. I mean, it was good to see the Seattle's offense really clicking on all cylinders today.
Yeah, on the backfield, and you know, this is a game that the Seahawks won easily. So Penny leads with 16 carries. Alex Collins has 6. DJ Dallas has 2. But what did you notice about like when that usage was coming? Like, was Penny still in the game when it was like clearly over? You know, were there any backups in the game, that type of thing? Or is this a good sign that Penny saw, you know, over twice as many carries as Collins?
Yes, and I think that's essentially what I saw, was that he was getting more of the base down work, continuing to still get carries, like even still when Houston was trying to at least make something of a competitive matchup of it, later in the fourth quarter, still getting carries there as well. So for all intents and purposes, I think we can really look at him as Seattle's RB1. Now looking at their upcoming matchups as we head into the fantasy playoffs, I mean, they do have the Rams like coming up, but a couple other favorable matchups like moving forward. So I think like for most folks, like if you were able to maybe snag Penny up, especially hearing that Alex Collins was banged up coming into this game, maybe stashed him on your bench. I mean, he should be a pretty decent RB2, RB3 option for you like moving forward.
Nice. And then you mentioned that Wilson looked good and was connecting with Lockett. Lockett had 142 yards and a touchdown here. Metcalf, not as big of a day, had 4 for 43 on 8 targets. But it sounds like it was kind of a vintage rust day.
Yeah, absolutely. And this was one of the things I had done some research for another article that I'd written earlier this week. But one of the reasons that I had some optimism for Russ, and actually I heard you talk about it on Davis Maddox's show earlier this week as well, was that one of the parts to Russ's game that we'd really liked is not just the deep passing, but his accuracy. His completion percentage over expected rank for the past like 4 seasons was, if I remember, like first, second, first, and fourth for the past 4 seasons. And after he came back from the finger injury, that was in what, like week 10, really saw that really plummet down to like bottom 5, bottom 6 in the league. But then after that, over the past few weeks, it started to pick back up. And then we really started to see it all come together today. Like even while, I mean, he finished 17 of 28. So completion percentage, I mean, not really like, you know, Russ levels in terms of accuracy like we would expect, but still seeing him be able to complete most of his passes, especially the deeper shots to Tyler Lockett. I mean, there were a few errant throws to DK Metcalf that some folks would have hoped would have wound up being touchdowns, especially a couple to DK in the red zone. But overall, seeing Russ already starting to trend in the right direction from a CPOE perspective gave me some hope that, especially in a matchup against Houston, who is like bottom 10 in EPA per dropback allowed. I mean, I think it all set up for Russ to have a day like we saw today.
Yeah, it's nice to see him come through here. I had the exact same assessment of thinking that this was a perfect setup for Russ, and nice to see him come through and deliver to Lockett, who, you know, one of the two big guys that we were going to be counting on. Would have been disappointing if he somehow had a big day for Will Disley or something. On the Texans side, what is there to say? I mean, I guess I'll just kind of throw this to you and talk about whoever you want, because I'm not sure that there's really anyone that's fantasy relevant here. I guess Brandon Cooks is slightly offended by that statement.
Yeah, I'd say Cooks is still going to be like the week in, week out wide receiver 2, wide receiver 3, just considering the situation he's in being attached to Davis Mills. But I'll give Mills credit. I mean, coming into this game, I mean, Seattle was, I believe, like 26th in EPA per dropback allowed. So we knew that this matchup was going to be, let's say, fairly easy for Mills to get through. And he delivered throughout most of the first half and into the second half. I would say it was like middle to end of the second quarter before he actually had his first incompletion. I think he was 15 for 15 before he wound up having his first completion, or wound up having to, saw him under pressure from Seattle, having to maybe break the pocket and scurry down the field or something like that and throw a pass like off into the sidelines or something like that. So for the most part, I think in a controlled environment or in an environment where he's not really put under pressure, he's able to complete some of those higher percentage throws where they were just beating Seattle over the head with screens or like crossers over the middle of the field, and Seattle just couldn't defend them. For quite some time, and he was able to connect with Cooks. He was able to connect with Nico Collins. I know a number of Dynasty folks are probably happy to see Collins getting into the mix. And also tight end Brevin Jordan, who actually caught the first touchdown. He was like completely wide open in the back right corner of the end zone. So to see him be able to, one, not only be Mills, I'm talking about, not only be somewhat efficient, but also seeing the mix of pass catchers that he was using. I mean, I don't think we're going to be thinking about Brandon Cooks as a Texan next season, but Nico Collins, Brevin Jordan, Jordan Akins was also mixing in out of the backfield as well. I mean, mostly as a blocker, but seeing like some of the younger pieces of that offense starting to see some work, I think that was a good sign for them moving forward.
Yeah, and Collins did have 69 yards here. Brevin Jordan had 26 and a touchdown. Cooks got over 100 yards, so credit to him for that, 8 for 101. And also credit to the Texans for throwing as much as they did, because, you know, you see sometimes the teams would just try to run the ball a bunch and get out of there. But Davis Mills did have 49 passing attempts, which, you know, is something. There's potentially some volume there. So that's definitely a little bit interesting. I guess the last thing I will ask you about Royce Freeman, because he had six receptions here on 8 targets, got 51 yards. Burkhead as well had 4 targets, going 4 for 26. But was Burkhead banged up in this game?
Yes, towards the middle of the fourth quarter, Burkhead left with a groin injury, and throughout most of the game, we saw at least a sprinkle of Royce Freeman here and there, but it was essentially be Rex Burkhead for 4 to 5 yards, or Rex Burkhead would catch a pass for 5 to 6 yards, and then Freeman would come in and get -2 yards, or he'd be dropped for a loss of like 4 to 5 yards. So the inefficiency, you can already see looking at the box score. I mean, 11 carries for 15 yards. You can see the inefficiency scream out at you from the box score, but really like his opportunity really started to come in like once like Burkhead was removed from the game, like towards the back end of it. So I wouldn't look at him as a fantasy option moving forward. I mean, the fact that he is getting opportunities out of the backfield, okay, fine. But still, I mean, for the situation with the Texans, I mean, that's not a really backfield that most folks would want to invest in anyway.
Let's move to the second game here. The 49ers defeated the Bengals 26-23, and a game in which George Kittle had 100 yards, now back-to-back 100-yard games for the first time in his career.
Yes, and I mean, George Kittle, everybody expected this out of him coming into the season, and then also now seeing this in back-to-back games. I mean, he really is that dude like for the 49ers. He was continually, I mean, if anytime the Bengals got pressure, I mean, they would try and blitz him. I know in the middle of the first half or towards the middle of the first half, I mean, Trey Hendrickson, one of the defensive players like for Cincinnati, actually wound up getting carted off. So their pass rush took a significant hit. And then afterwards, anytime the Bengals did wind up sending pressure, if they wound up getting through the pocket and Jimmy Garoppolo would have to stumble back and try and figure out who the ball was going to go to, it would go to George Kittle. I mean, they would just be able to completely hammer the Bengals with some of those crossing patterns across the middle of the field. I mean, it kept George Kittle like getting some of that yak even after the catch. It looked like it was going to be a sort of a weaker output from Kittle throughout the first quarter. They seemed to kind of bottle him up, at least from restricting a lot of the yards after the catch for the first quarter or so. But after that, I mean, once they lost Hendrickson, once some of the Bengals' penalties and turnovers on special teams really gave them the shorter fields for San Francisco to work from, after that, it was just all over. And Garoppolo was able to move the football for the most part with ease.
Yeah, and Brandon Ayuk was the guy who scored the game-winning touchdown here. And he had 62 yards on 6 catches, so a nice game for him as well. This is also Debo Samuel's return. He had 1 for 22, but also 8 for 37 as a rusher and got in the end zone on the ground. So talk to me a bit about Samuel and Ayuk.
So for Samuel, the concern coming in, obviously with him coming off of being injured for the past couple of weeks, was what that workload was going to look like. I didn't expect to see as much of him as a rusher, but I think the other part I was trying to balance out in my head was that Jeff Wilson is nowhere near the type of rusher that they've had over the past, let's say, even throughout the entire season. I mean, whether it was at the very beginning of the season, I mean, think about the archetypes of running backs that they've used so far. I mean, I'll include Deebo Samuel in the mix, whether it's been Raheem Mostert, whether it's been Elijah Mitchell, and now Deebo Samuel. I mean, those are quick guys. I mean, not just fast. I'm talking about quick, being able to get to the outside edge and on those toss plays that San Francisco like runs almost repeatedly. Jeff Wilson's not that dude. He doesn't have that same speed that the rest of those guys do. And so I always had like some concern about Wilson's workload, but at the same time, trying to balance that with the fact that Deebo Samuel really is like not necessarily the engine for that offense, but for as much as they wind up using the running plays so far, I mean, they're bottom five, bottom six in pass rate over expectation. It did make some sense for them to limit Samuel in this game back. They only used him in some of those more critical situations. We saw him get in the end zone on a rushing play, but afterwards we really didn't see him all too much. And even in overtime, I mean, it really was just a George Kittle and Brandon Ayuk show. And for the fact that they were able to move the ball with Kittle, I mean, essentially move the ball in 3 to 4 yard chunks, like with Wilson. I mean, they essentially didn't need Samuel. I mean, if they had wound up losing this game in overtime, I guess there might have been more questions for Shanahan. But for the most part, I mean, Garoppolo was able to at least continue to be efficient without using or leaning on Samuel like they had in weeks past.
On the Bengals side, this was a pretty big game for Ja'Marr Chase because he got in the end zone twice. And then I believe also had another potential touchdown overturned. T. Higgins, though, also had a nice game, 5 for 114 on 7 targets. So the two big receivers here coming through. Tyler Boyd, much more quiet, 4 for 55. C.J. Uzomah actually had a pretty decent game, 4 for 56, based on what we expect from him, kind of exceeding those expectations. So what were your thoughts on the Bengals passing game?
I think from a macro sense, and I've seen some quotes like from Zach Taylor's presser afterwards, is I'm really disappointed in the play calling. If you even go into the second drive in overtime, the first drive, they come out with passes to Higgins. They start moving the ball down the field. But on that second drive, it was just two runs to Joe Mixon, and then Joe Burrow gets sacked on third down. And that's when they have to kick the field goal in order to go up by 3. And then afterwards, we know what happened after that with Ayuk getting the walk-off touchdown in order to end the game. And that was kind of emblematic of how Cincinnati was calling their passing plays throughout the game. I think like since their bye, their pass rate over expectation just on first downs is at like -8%. And really that kind of, I guess, that puts a stamp on how run heavy like they've been like over the past like 4 or 5 weeks. And so seeing and it just comes in bursts, like their aggression to Chase, their aggression to Higgins, it comes in bursts. And there's really no sort of consistency when we can expect to see Burrow kind of, I guess, let it like uncork a ball to either of the two. So it was great to see Boyd and Uzomah start to get mixed in. So if they don't have some of those deeper shots or intermediate shots to Higgins or Chase, like on tap, they can actually rely on Boyd or Uzomah to get the ball moving. But I think overall, I think there needs to be at least a much deeper discussion within the coaching staff as to how they're going to deploy their offense moving forward.
Yeah, that's interesting. Joe Mixon here, pretty quiet, 3.2 yards per carry, went 58 yards on 18 attempts. And he wasn't actually all that involved as a receiver, only having 2 receptions for 10 yards on 2 targets. So thoughts on the backfield in addition to kind of the way they're designing this offense?
I was wondering the same thing, like as the game was kind of unfolding, because it seemed like in a number of critical situations, even just whether they're third down conversions or even obvious like third down passing situations, it was Samaje Perine that was actually on the field. Now, I'm more than willing to chalk this up to because Mixon came into this game sick. I know that there were concerns like from some of the fantasy doctors around the industry, whether it's Edwin Portas or like Dr. Gene Bramall, regarding like his status for this game. Of course, we had to at least consider the fact that if he needed to be hydrated in the days leading up to this game, of course, they might want to give Samaje Perine a little bit more run. So I think that's what kind of led more to us seeing more Perine, both as a runner. He was involved on a number of third downs, like throughout the regular portion of the game. I think it was mostly Joe Mixon once they got into overtime. But yeah, I think that's more of the blip that we see from here, because otherwise, I think Joe Mixon would at least been able to salvage his day as a pass catcher. But given the fact that he was sick, given the fact that they wound up actually putting in Piran for a few more extra plays or a few more extra series than we normally would see. I think that's kind of contributes to why we see Joe Mixon having at least a little bit more disappointing day from a fantasy perspective than what we were used to over the past 4 to 5 weeks.
That makes sense, given, you know, he was battling an illness. So hopefully his role increases a bit more next week. But Chris Allen, thanks so much.
Anytime.
The Chiefs defeated the Raiders 48-9 in a scoregami, the first time the NFL has ever had a 48-9 game, as noted by Scott Hansen on NFL Red Zone. I covered this game for us, and let's start with the Chiefs side of things. This was really where things happened in this game. Patrick Mahomes looked really good. He looked like vintage Patrick Mahomes, doing Patrick Mahomes things. He hung in the pocket and took a big hit on a 44-yard reception or a pass to Mecole Hardman. He also had a really nice pass to Tyreek Hill for 38 yards, where Mahomes escaped the pocket, kind of like does that thing where he sort of shuffles steps toward the sideline as he looks downfield, and then hit Tyreek Hill on the complete opposite side of the field, deep. You know, it was a really nice throw, and he had a couple longer throws to Tyreek Hill. They had a pretty good connection in this game. Tyreek Hill only had 76 yards, going four receptions for 76 yards in this game. But it was the type of game where the Chiefs didn't need to keep their foot on the gas. Mahomes only had 258 yards passing and two touchdowns, but he completed 20 of 24 passes. I mean, he was very much on in this game. It's just the type of game where the Raiders never push back at any point. And even from the very start of this game, Josh Jacobs got a fumble punched out, and it was returned for a touchdown. And the Chiefs were just rolling the entire game. The two touchdowns that Mahomes had, one was a quick pass to Josh Gordon, just a goal line. It was following a Darrell Williams carry that nearly got in, and he was able to just follow up with a short pass. And the second touchdown was a swing pass. This is actually the first touchdown pass that Mahomes threw, was a swing pass to Darrell Williams, where Travis Kelce executed a nice pick play, and Darrell Williams was able to take it in for 23 yards. So, you know, neither of the touchdown passes that Mahomes threw was particularly fantasy relevant, which was a little bit of disappointment. But Clyde Edwards-Helaire had a pretty solid game here. He scored two touchdowns on the ground. He could have had a third on that Darrell Williams carry, where Darrell Williams has stopped just short of the goal line. Clyde Edwards-Helaire had been given a carry on the previous snap, but there was a missed exchange. So the Chiefs seemed to believe it was on Clyde Edwards-Helaire because he's not in for the following snap. Then he's not in for the snap following that, which is the touchdown to Josh Gordon. Then he's not in on the following drive. Derek Gordon instead is in. So there seemed to be like a, not exactly a benching, but a very short benching seemed to have occurred with the CEH fumble, which basically cost him a chance at a third touchdown in this game. But he did have a nice touchdown run on a pitch, and then a nice, I would say a slightly better touchdown run on a 6-yard touchdown carry later on. So 5 and 6-yard touchdowns for Clyde Edwards-Helaire. Pretty solid day, although didn't do much other than that, only 37 yards rushing. In complete garbage time, Derek Gordon had a 51-yard touchdown. Looked really good on it, had a nice burst, but just total garbage time. Chad Henne was in. So, you know, you look at the box score, you see 66 yards on 9 rushes for Derek Gore. He was, like I mentioned, involved at times throughout the game before it was completely out of hand, but he was also just in total mop-up duty. So nothing really to see here with Derek Gordon. And, you know, nothing really to see here with much else besides, you know, Tyreek Hill. As far as the receivers go, Mecole Hardman did get that nice 44-yard reception. Byron Pringle, though, only had one 28-yard reception. So, you know, kind of split up. The ancillary stuff seems pretty split up. Travis Kelce had a disappointing game. He went 3 for 27 here. This, I think, is less concerning than last week when he also went 3 for 27 because, again, they just didn't need to push things. So, you know, Travis Kelce, his best play of the day was actually the pick play that kind of freed up Darrell Williams, and not anything he did through the air. I expect that, you know, if we get even more than a half out of the Chiefs' offense, Travis Kelce will get back on track. Although, obviously, his lack of production has been a little bit concerning. On the Raiders' side, I mentioned the Josh Jacobs fumble that kicked things off. That obviously set the exact wrong tone for this game. Josh Jacobs did not ever get going on the ground. He only had 24 yards on the ground. He also had, though, five catches for 46 yards, particularly before the first half, was used heavily on checkdowns, and that saved his fantasy day to an extent. I mean, still not that great, 5 for 46 through the air, 24 yards on 9 rushes on the ground, but not nothing. And, you know, you're basically getting nothing out of pretty much everything in this offense. Zay Jones had a lost fumble that also led to that was in total garbage time. It was just kind of the icing on the cake of, like, you know, they just can't stop turning the ball over. Derek Carr technically had an interception in this game, but it was not like really an interception in any kind of meaningful way, where what happened was he hit Foster Moreau. Foster Moreau like didn't fully complete the process of the catch, but had the ball knocked into the air and then it was caught. So it was really a fumble in terms of like whose fault it was, but it was charged as an interception. So that was not Carr's fault. And Carr overall like didn't play terribly. He had only one touchdown throw, threw for 263 yards on 45 attempts. He was just under pressure pretty constantly, and he was not connecting with his receivers in this game. He did not seem to have any rapport with his receivers, including Moreau. Moreau actually had a chance to fall on a Hunter Renfrow fumble later on and was not able to. Renfrow also lost a fumble in this game. So just tons and tons of turnovers in this game for the Raiders. And Renfrow, though, you know, despite losing that fumble, I would say was the real only bright spot for the Raiders in this game. He is the one who got in the end zone here, the only Raider to score a touchdown. Nice kind of, you know, fakes inside, bursts outside, you know, he kind of like getting open in the phone booth type of thing. And that's what Renfrow does. Did it excellently on that play. Was able to catch the ball in the short area and take it in a yard or two for the touchdown. So, you know, that was pretty solid. And he was also, he had some nice yards after the catch plays and just kind of an outlet constantly for Carr. I mean, he was like the engine of the offense. But, you know, when you have a like slot receiver, like a reliable slot receiver who's used very shallowly as the true engine of your offense, it's kind of a symptom of, you know, an offense that's not firing on all cylinders. And the Raiders certainly weren't here. Overall, you know, kind of a burn the tape game for the Raiders, and a game that I think makes you feel better about Patrick Mahomes. Obviously, this was kind of the spot we saw him go off against the Raiders previously. This coverage really works to his advantage. I would say, like, with the long catches and everything, when he was hitting Tyreek Hill in particular, Mahomes was not like hitting Hill in stride down the sideline for 38 yards. It's like there were still guys behind Hill. There were still players behind Hill. The Raiders were playing kind of deep coverage, but just like probably too deep. And that was allowing Mahomes to find guys, you know, 30 yards downfield, but still kind of not over the top of the safeties. But anyway, that'll do it for the Raiders and the Chiefs. The Falcons defeated the Panthers 29-21. This is now the fifth time that Cam Newton has gotten benched in his last 14 starts. That's a note from our research team here.
Yikes.
I actually don't know if they're counting one time or two time in this game, Patrick Daugherty, because correct me if I'm wrong, but did Cam get benched in this game twice?
He did. And I know without the stats and research team, he's been benched three times in his past two starts. And today was at the end of the first half. And then at the end of the game, like the final 5 minutes of the game, Matt Rhule, speaking after the game, said that Cam was still the starter, but like that PJ Walker was more up to speed in the two-minute drill, which, you know, kind of makes sense, like in theory, because you know, he's been in the offense all year. But, you know, Cam, 11-year NFL veteran, pretty sure he probably knows how to run a two-minute offense, especially, you know, he's still familiar with a lot of this Panthers personnel. So I think that Matt Rhule is kind of trying to have his cake and eat it too, and understandably at a loss for what to do. Cause I mean, PJ Walker came in at the end of the first half and immediately tossed a horrific interception, like off his back foot into like triple zone coverage. And Yeah, Cam, by the letter of the law, though, he was benched twice, and it was for the most critical moments of the game. And P.J. Walker did nothing the first time. He was not good the second time, though he did provide their only passing touchdown of the entire day.
What kind of cake is this that Matt Rhule is trying to have and eat? Because it seems like a really disgusting cake that, that no one should be trying to eat.
Yeah, he's like trying to, you know, it's such a hopeless quarterback situation that he's at least nearing the point where like the, you know, there's no good way out of this, but he's at least to the point now where he can like kind of excuse free use either quarterback. It seems like that seems like what he's aiming for, like where he's not going to be questioned and he's just like shuttling them in and out. Because even if P.J. Walker were to like become the starter, which again, Matt Rhule has said will not be the case for week 15 against the Bills. I mean, I think we're all pretty sure Cam Newton would still be coming in for essentially every red zone series, or definitely like inside the 10 yard line. And that, yeah, it's starting to seem like this might be like a two quarterback situation the rest of the way. And Matt Rhule just desperately like trying to play like hot hand quarterback, which, you know, isn't going to work at the NFL level, barely works at the college level. There were some weird splits. So like, P.J. Walker, Robbie Anderson set new season highs for catches with 7, yards with 84, targets, I believe, with 12. And like a huge, like the vast majority of his production came with P.J. Walker under center. 4 of his catches, 55 of his yards, and his touchdown came with P.J. Walker under center, which probably is not a coincidence. You know, P.J. Walker like actually trying to like force the ball down the field, something that Cam Newton just can't do right now. Yeah, I think Matt Rhule is who like keeps like creating worse and worse options for himself at quarterback is now just going to like try to like play matchups, so to speak, or like play situational football with his two quarterbacks.
Yeah, it doesn't seem great. DJ Moore had 6 for 84. I guess he was connecting more with Newton.
He was. All 6 and 84 of that was from Newton. And then, you know, that's been a bright spot the past 2 weeks. DJ Moore has – he's cleared – he's gotten to 100 yards both games. He has not done that. He's gotten to 10 targets both games. He's gotten to at least 84 yards both games after like a pretty long stretch of like, you know, like 455, you know, 542. He's at least gotten the usage spiked back up since they've like officially moved on from Sam Darnold. And, but you know, like the ceiling is still so hard to come by. And so some of that yardage was really hard earned on some like bad targets from Cam Newton that he had to kind of lay out to get. He like paid a price for it too. He tweaked his wrist real early in the game, DJ Moore. They hurt his right leg in the second half. He played through both, but seemed like guy was probably gonna have his practice reps managed this week. And but yeah, they're at least Cam Newton, say what you, is at least doing that. He is getting the ball to DJ Moore. He's not messing around in that department. He is targeting his number one weapon.
In the backfield, Chuba Hubbard had 33 yards rushing. Amir Abdullah had 16. Cam Newton actually led the team with 47 rushing yards. Amir Abdullah had 2 for 17 as a receiver. Hubbard not targeted. So just really nothing out of the backfield. One of the things that, you know, you deal with Newton is that he can steal the rushing touchdowns. He did get a rushing touchdown here. Hubbard actually had one as well. But I don't know. I would also think maybe there could be some more efficiency on the ground as well. And Hubbard had 3.3 yards per carry, which includes a 17-yard run. So those seems like they were really struggling to move the ball outside of Cam rushing.
Yeah, and with Chuba, it was basically like they were basically like doing a how-to on how not to have flex value, because he got vultured at the goal line by Cam. He got out-targeted 4-0 by Amir Abdullah. Like you said, he wasn't efficient. He did get the touchdown, but it wasn't a goal line carry. It's a 17-yard touchdown. You know, it's a good thing he can score a 17-yard touchdown. It was a nice read option. He made a really, really nice cutback. But his closest thing to a goal line carry was from 11 yards out. Like, again, Cam got the true goal line carry. Cam is going to get almost all the true goal line carries, because Cam, you know, for being over 30, for struggling as a passer, looks essentially unstoppable still, like he did for the Patriots last year in those situations. And that's just not going to be Chuba. And yeah, if he's not getting zero targets, if he's not going to be getting targeted, and he's not the first option at the goal line, you know, week 15 is the first time since week 5 that all 32 teams are going to be playing no bye weeks. And with like that full player pool, it's going to be, I mean, he's going to be a flex, Chuba, but he's going to be like a flex like you do not feel good about against the Buffalo Bills.
On the Falcons side here, Cordarrelle Patterson had 55 yards rushing. and a touchdown. He only had 2 receptions for 1 yard, did have 5 targets, but 16 carries and 5 targets, kind of looking like a running back in terms of the usage. What did you notice in terms of him? And like, was he in a kind of that classic hybrid role, or was he more like a true running back this week?
I will say it was surprising that he only caught 2 passes, because it did feel like he was still getting like the Austin Eckler, like slasher type usage. But yeah, 2 catches for 1 yard speaks for itself. And what really caught your attention with Cordarrelle Patterson, if you're watching this game, is that he did not play in the 4th quarter. And no one has quite gotten to the bottom of this yet. Maybe by the time you're listening to this podcast, there's an update on that, because he was not announced with an injury. It was definitely not like a team-imposed suspension or anything. After the game, I was scouring for information, and the Falcons' official account posted a post-game social media video from Cordero where he was very happy about the dub, like shouting out, you know, Falcons Nation or whatever. And, you know, he was a very jolly, jovial mood. And so he was not suspended. They claim he was not hurt. He was never announced with an injury. No word of an injury in the post-game press conference, but just very strange. The only thing I could maybe think of was like they went up 26-14 in the opening minutes of the 4th quarter. Maybe they decided it was a good time to like get him a rest, because you have a huge workload for a guy who's never had these kind of workloads in his career.
But I would just 30.
Yeah. I just wouldn't be shocked if at some point during the week words slipped of some sort of issue. But there it was radio silence on that on Sunday. And maybe just an oddity of the season and nothing to worry about, but something to monitor this week.
Interesting, because that, you know, Mike Davis had 11 carries for 44 yards, and he actually had 6 targets going 5 for 42 as a receiver. So one of Mike Davis's better days, but maybe that's like a little bit inflated by the weird Patterson usage.
Yeah, it was Mike Davis's. It was his most touches since week 3. It was the first time in 5 weeks he had double-digit touches. This came too as Quadra Olison lost a really bad, really soft 4th quarter fumble. So kind of like strange things afoot in that Falcons backfield. But or maybe it's just being whittled back down to 2 backs. But yeah, again, Cordarrelle Patterson, hopefully it's nothing. Maybe this is the last you're going to hear of it, is this podcast. But just something to keep an eye on this week.
Anything to note for the receivers here? I mean, Kyle Pitts kind of came back to life a little bit, 5 for 61. Russell Gage came back down to earth, 4 for 64.
Yeah, not a whole lot. I mean, Matt Ryan, like, this was not a good performance for Matt Ryan. Like, he left a lot of meat on the bone. He had 0 interceptions if you look at the box score, but that was very, very misleading. He threw several, maybe 3 to 4 interceptable passes. Like some that just like clanged right off like Panthers defenders' hand. Like there, it was like a top 1 percentile day for like the cameraman zooming in on Panthers defenders with like their hands on their helmets. Like, how did I not intercept that ball? Kyle Pitts, if you're looking for a bright spot, yeah, 5 for 61. His high, you know, it was like his highest catch total in like 5 weeks. I think it was his highest yardage total in 5 weeks, like his highest reception total in 7 weeks. You can find that stat on our blurb. I forget what the exact stat is. And 2 of his catches, 1 converted a 3rd and 13 in the 3rd quarter, or 3rd and 14, excuse me. And then 1 in the 4th quarter converted a 3rd and 13. That essentially iced the game. He was sent in motion before. He was left uncovered as he crossed the formation. Then kind of like glided to like a 23-yard gain. You know, looked really, really dangerous, like we've seen him at times this year. And so hopefully something to build on for him. You know, going into a matchup with a tough Bills defense, one that is limited tight end production. But yeah, it was his best game in quite some time.
Well, you mentioned the Bills. That's the next game that you had, where the Buccaneers defeated the Bills 33-27. Tom Brady has the record for most completions in NFL history now. This was an overtime game, a pretty exciting game, but ultimately the Buccaneers pull it out.
Yeah, you know, kind of like a very characteristic Tom Brady game where he just dominated, and uncharacteristic where they were winning 24-3 at halftime. So very, very un-Tom Brady-like that this game like made it to overtime. He had 216 yards, I think, at halftime out of like his 368 or whatever. He had his rushing touchdown in the first half. They were just like coasting, doing whatever they wanted in the first half. And yeah, I think it was just one of those things. They were up big. It seems like it's so easy to get out of sync when you're up big. They just got – and, like, it was, like, such a dire moment for the Bills. You know, kind of like a cornered animal moment for the Bills. Like, Bills' season on the line in the second half. it's like a huge mismatch in terms of like motivation. But I mean, I don't know if that's actually why it happened. But yeah, a strange game from that perspective. But Tom Brady, like, he looked sharp. Had a laser to Mike Evans in the end zone. The walk-off 58-yard touchdown to Breshad Perriman, like real feathery ball placement on a crossing route, and like that was that. So he was closer to even a much bigger day. He had 368 yards, but several like 50-50 balls that him and Gronk were so close to connecting on and just couldn't quite do it. So, yeah, it was a strange game in terms of sequencing for Tom Brady. But, yeah, I think he became the first player in NFL history to have 700 combined postseason and regular season touchdowns on Sunday. So Tom Brady, he's just going to keep getting away with this forever, Pat.
Apparently. Yeah, I've actually kind of gone the other way. At this point, I'm just like, I don't know. If there was like a 55-year-old quarterback in the NFL, that'd be pretty cool. So
yeah, I know. It is true. A quick aside, I'm coming that way on both Brady and Belichick. You know, like 2013, you're just like, why? Like, just please stop. Yes. And now like, Brady is like, whatever. Yeah, I'm into like the cyborg quarterback. Like Belichick, I'm like super into like evil genius Belichick. You're like zagging as the NFL is zigging. And he's going full pass. He's just manipulating Mac Jones's every movement. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, I'm like less in on the Belichick stuff, but I get it. Let's talk about Chris Godwin, who had 15 targets here, just massive target shares and totals over the last couple weeks. Went 10 for 105. Mike Evans went 6 for 91 and had a really nice touchdown catch. Gronkowski had 5 for 62. Breshad Perriman had the walk-off touchdown. Really nice yards after catch on that. Just the single 58-yard touchdown to ice it. But that kind of sums up the receivers here. Thoughts on the receiving crew here for Brady?
Well, yeah, just with Godwin real quick. I mean, we're just – the past 2 weeks we've been getting like that, you know, like that mutant – like souped up version of Julian Edelman. We kind of always thought Chris Godwin could be for Tom Brady. 25 catches over the past two weeks.
Wild.
Back-to-back 10 catch performances. And Antonio Brown is suspended at least one more game. You know, we don't know for sure if he's going to rejoin the Bucs. He's probably going, if they were going to cut him, you know, they probably would have cut him by now. So Antonio Brown is probably coming back, but yeah, he's out one more week. We know when he comes back, it's not going to be like, they're not going to like just pick up where they left off. You know, like this three-headed monster receiver. They're not going to like just like re-gift Antonio Brown in every down role. Like, they're probably going to make him, you know, just from conditioning too. They're going to have to like work him back in. And Chris Godwin looks like someone, he put the PPR squad on his back headed into the playoffs. And he looks like he's gunning for a trophy in the fantasy world before going for another one in the real world.
Yeah, it's been pretty impressive. Leonard Fournette also had 4 for 19. Through the air on 7 targets. And he also had 113 yards rushing on 19 carries and a touchdown. You mentioned that Brady got in the end zone on a quarterback sneak as well. But yeah, Fournette, not like the biggest day, but certainly kind of maintaining the clear workhorse role here.
Yeah, I mean, Rojo only had 3 touches. Sorry, Pat. I know it's a sore subject, of course.
I mean, it's the ship has sailed on Rojo. Yeah,
the ship has sailed. And, you know, Fournette, he like never gets 20 carries, but it was his quietest receiving day in some time, but he's averaging 5 catches still. I mean, we know he's going to catch basically 5 balls every week. He's getting lots and lots of goal line opportunities. And yeah, even with all 32 teams back, like I said, for week 15, Fournette he seemed like he's determined to remain in that RB1 mix.
Yep. Josh Allen had pretty amazing game here. You know, for anyone who had him on DraftKings, he gets the bonus through the air going 308 yards. So you get 300-yard bonus. You get your 100-yard bonus on the ground. He rushed for 109 yards and a touchdown through for 308 and 2 touchdowns and an interception. Kind of, you know, doing everything we like to see, except doesn't get the win and then also is now going to get an MRI on his ankle, I believe.
Yeah, I mean, via the CBS booth, only the 4th time in NFL history, joining Russell Wilson, Lamar Jackson, and I believe, I forget who the 4th is, another recent duel, Cam Newton, the 4th time in NFL history, a quarterback's had 300 passing yards and 100 rushing yards. And quite the feat after, you know, the Bills, again, it was 24-3 at halftime. They literally did not have a running back rush in the first half. It was all Josh Allen. And then they had a lot of design Josh Allen runs in the second half. But yeah, as you alluded to, you know, that's a high-risk style. Like I tweeted during the game, they were running their Josh Allen punctured lung offense, like really exposing him to hits, and yeah, resulted in a left foot injury, like his foot or his toe. They were both getting examined on the sideline. He did stay in the game. He still looked very wily, very dangerous. You know, that could have been adrenaline. And he seems like, yeah, someone who's not going to get in a full week of practice. But, you know, unless the MRI reveals like a Jones fracture or something, hard to believe he's going to miss any time with the Bills season on the line.
Thoughts on his receivers? Cole Beasley was targeted heavily here, 9 for 64 on 11 targets. Stephon Diggs targeted very heavily, 13 targets, but only 7 for 74. Dawson Knox had 7 for 60 and a touchdown on 9 targets. Gabriel Davis also got in the end zone, 5 for 43 on 8 targets.
Yeah, I mean, the calculus was changed because at halftime, Emmanuel Sanders was announced as done for the day with a knee injury. He had only one catch before going down, but that kind of finally clarified things to the Bills receiver core in the second half. And yet, Cole Beasley's biggest game in like 2 months. He had not looked healthy for a long time, definitely looked healthy on Sunday. Gabriel Davis scored for the second straight game, you know, made a couple of really big plays, like some big conversions. Like he's just one of those guys. He seems like, I think he's like a much more explosive athlete than Kendrick Bourne, but he kind of reminds me of Kendrick Bourne in terms of like, he's just like a playmaker. Like he's somehow always, when he gets the ball, like is doing something important, it feels like. And if Steph had the 7 for 74, as you probably know by now, if you're watching the game, I mean, could have been 9 easily. He just brutalized for 2 pass interference calls that were not called. And, but yeah, you know, the ceiling has not been there for Steph, but the floor has remained very, very high for Steph. And it's a tough matchup, though, next week in the Panthers, who are not a pushover pass defense. But it seems like 6 to 7 catches is still just a given for Steph.
Yep. As far as the backfield goes, a note here from our research team, no rushing attempts by a running back for the Bills in the first half, which is both pretty wild and also like, yeah, it's the Bills.
Yeah. And their first rushing attempt was a Matt Breida fake punt rush in the third quarter that was stopped, not converted. So, but then, I mean, to like add fuel to the fire, I think their first actual rush then was like a 29-yard Devin Singletary run. He had an 18-yard run a few minutes later. It's like, oh, you know, maybe you should mix in a run occasionally just to keep the defense honest. And Zach Moss was healthy scratch the second time in 3 weeks. And they just seemed like they're making it up as they go. I mean, that part's not made up. It made sense that Zach Moss, they didn't think he was going to have success against this elite run defense, but they do not have a consistent or coherent. Because, you know, all these designed Josh Allen runs today, where were these against the Patriots last week? You know, a game where, like, basically, right, he could not throw because of the weather. And it just seems like they cannot settle on a coherent approach to their running game.
It is odd. Allen rushed 12 times, so there was kind of a rushing element still, even though there weren't actually running backs involved. Any takes on Singletary versus Breida? I mean, Singletary got 7 targets here, going 6 for 37. He's involved in the kind of only way that the running backs are involved, I guess.
Yeah, he out-touched Breida 10-3. Like, so he actually was making some chunk plays in the running game, too. Seems to be clearly the lead back. For whatever reason, they had really high hopes for, like, Matt Breida, like, changing the mojo in their backfield over the past 2 weeks. And that has not happened. Three touches, you know, hit the fumble 2 weeks ago. And, I wouldn't be surprised at all if, like, Zach Moss is back to being the number 2 next week. But the only, like, Devin Singletary is like the clear lead back in this backfield right now.
All right. Patrick Daugherty, thanks so much.
My pleasure, other Pat.
The Saints defeated the Jets 30-9. Alvin Kamara leading the way, now has the most receptions for a running back in his first 5 seasons in NFL history with 362, and also had a career high 27 carries today. Kyle Dvorak, Alvin Kamara doing it both ways here as a receiver and as a rusher.
Yeah, I mean, he looked as good as he ever has, really. Was explosive, got the ball a ton, which is something he kind of doesn't do all that much. As pointed out, 27 isn't a crazy number, but it still is a career high. 26 was a high before. I think he got that early this year as well. So it was just typical Kamara. I was going to say he didn't seem limited at all by coming off the injury that sidelined him for, I believe, 3 games, if I remember that correctly. But the thing was, he actually didn't get the first carry of the game. Tony Jones didn't for the first carry of the game. And then the broadcast talked about how, oh, well, Sean Payton told us Saturday in some, you know, the media relations or whatever they do. They actually thought about, they were saying Kamara was on a pitch count. Sean Payton was saying this. And obviously that didn't pan out to be true. Kamara gets 2 carries, look explosive. And Sean Payton's like, okay, admittedly, I was wrong. Let's give him a career high in carries. So I think it was a bit of just sort of coach speak saying, like, we don't want, like, nobody wants, like, if you don't have to, Kamara, no player should touch the ball. Football is violent and dangerous. No player should touch the ball 27 times. But when they're playing as efficiently as they are and you're killing the Jets, it does make some sense to you know, take this pitch count that was probably never that real in the first place completely off the table. He looked great. Clearly not, even though Payton told the broadcast that at some point, clearly not limited at all, both in terms of his physical ability and his usage. And I think we kind of project this going forward. I do think the only concern would be, like, not a crazy receiving game from him. He got there through the air as perfectly fine. It was 4 or 5 catches, I believe. Nothing crazy. And that's something we've kind of seen with Taysom Hill, is that his overall receiving numbers drop. But it was also just a low passing volume game from the team. So you can't even be that concerned by the raw numbers, because they still are underlied by a solid target share.
Yeah, I'm actually encouraged a little bit by what he did as a receiver, because he had 5 targets here, which was second most on the team, going 4 for 25. And, you know, Taysom Hill only threw for 175 yards. Nick Vinette led the team with 44 yards receiving. Marcus Callaway was second, 34. Tre'Quan Smith with 33 was third. So Alvin Kamara is, like, right there in the mix among the leading receivers. I definitely think, you know, it's nice that he can have this kind of day with really nothing going on in the receiving game in general. I'm not even sure there's that much to say about the receiving game other than, like, Taysom Hill still got there as a fantasy asset despite only throwing for 175 yards, despite not throwing for a touchdown, because he did have a 2-touchdown day on the ground going 73 yards, and he had a long touchdown, I believe, like, in total garbage time to close out the game, right?
Yeah, so the broadcast pointed this out, and they said, like, in the replay, it does look like he looks at his own sideline. I assume they're all yelling, go down, go down, because at that point, I think there's about a minute on the clock, if I remember it correctly, and they literally could have just ended the game, just he go down at the 20, take a bunch of knees. I mean, he could have literally gone down as soon as he got the first down, take a bunch of knees, but he just keeps on going. If you played him in fantasy, I'm sure you're watching, you're like, don't go down, don't go down, and he keeps on running. He runs to daylight and scores, padding his own stats, padding the fantasy numbers. But had that happened at a different point in the game, we wouldn't sort of be joking about it. We'd be like, yeah, Taysom Hill sometimes rakes long runs. So yeah, he had a good game, and it was only as a rusher, really. Not awfully surprising. That's kind of what we expect from him. He did seem to still have a little bit of grip issues with the mallet finger injury. It was in the first half at some point. He just did the iconic, goes to cock the ball back to take a throw and just throws it behind him. He just can't grip the ball. So when he brings it up to, like, shoulder, you know, chin height, heads on right behind him, ball just keeps on going. He takes it for a 19-yard loss. I think he jumps on it, and then technically it goes down as a sack because someone touches the downed quarterback. So wasn't a perfect day in terms of how that mallet finger issue looked, but it's not where we're playing. And we're not like, oh man, he can't throw 60-yard dimes or an 80% completion rate. No, that was never the thesis of the play. It was always that he's a good runner, and he still is a very good runner. And if you know, for a DFS perspective or something, you probably shouldn't be stacking him. Like, we don't even know, like, who his top receivers are, right? It was Nick Vinette in this game after being, I believe, Deontay Harris last game, and then little Jordan Humphrey, who was inactive, also scored last game. It's just a complete mess. It was maybe sort of trending towards Tre'Quan Smith, but we didn't really see that in this game, nor should we really expect any consistency. So play him naked, expect rushing touchdowns, and that's really all you're playing him for.
Yep. What is the thesis of the play at this point with Zach Wilson?
Who is making, there isn't, are you, like, FanDuel has a bad quarterbacks league that you can play.
There you go.
You know, I've theorized on Twitter about the score the fewest points leagues, where you just try and score the fewest points, but not zero. You're heavily penalized for scoring zero. By penalized, I mean you score more points because you're trying to score the fewest. Zach Wilson fits that bill, although he's also a threat to go under zero. It feels like he's just not very good right now, and that's okay. He's got time to figure things out. His receiving core has been in and out all year. His offensive line isn't great by any means, but, like, he's just not that good right now. And again, that's fine. He's a young kid. He's got time to figure it out. But you just have to call a spade a spade. He's playing pretty horribly right now. He, like, his top options were also not good, and they didn't play well. He had a lot of throws that were, like, I think Pro Football Focus would grade them catchable and accurate, I think what they call it, on frame, in the sense of a receiver's catch radius can physically catch it, but they were not close enough to be like easy catch and run type of throws. And his receivers, to Wilson's credit, or to spread the blame more accurately, did not catch a single one of these catchable inaccurate throws. There was, I believe, a Keelan Cole, what I would call on target ish drop. Ty Johnson, I believe, had three drops. I know for sure he had two. I do believe all three of his non-caught targets were all some form of drop. They weren't great. Not all of them, at least, were like perfectly in the breadbasket throws. But for a young, struggling quarterback, I gotta imagine it's frustrating if you're a Jets fan. Like, please, someone help this guy out. He needs the help. He's not playing well. And his players are actively not doing anything to also help him. It was a disaster on all fronts. And the weirdest, I don't know if this is the weirdest thing or not. Austin Walter, like, we projected maybe, oh, this would be a sort of backfield where you just pick up a few targets because they're going to be passing a lot, and some carries, and that's good PPR value. It's like discount Jeff Wilson or Rashad Penny or whatever. Austin Walter was active for this game and then immediately rolled out because of an illness. There's no one we can trust in the backfield. There are no pass catchers we can trust. It's not that there's not a thesis to play Zach Wilson. Should just never be playing Jets at this point. Never. I can't imagine why you would.
Yeah, I agree. I think that'll do it for the Jets recap. Let's move over to the Broncos defeating the Lions 38-10. This is a game where the Broncos honored Demaryius Thomas in a pregame tribute. Obviously, Thomas tragically passed away this past week, and the Broncos here scored 38 points, a season high.
Yeah, I mean, Lions, they came into this game where they actually had been like decent in some spots against the run. The problem was that from a fantasy perspective, it didn't really matter how good they were against the run because it was so frequent that teams would run against them. They gave up the highest run play rate in the league entering this game. It's exactly what we saw from Denver, except Denver has not only Javonte Williams super efficient, but also Melvin Gordon came back and looked really good, was breaking tackles and springing some long sort of chunk gains. Both running backs looked great. They did the same split that you and I joked about. I'm ready to be hurt. I would argue this hurt a little bit from a Javonte perspective. Hurt. But Melvin Gordon played admittedly very well in this game. He did not show you anything that said you have to be playing, you have to be benching him, right? Especially when you add on top of just this coach's deference to veterans. So I understand why they just let him continue rolling, but I believe it was 24-15. That was kind of the focal point. They ran all over the Lions and he outcarried Javonte 24-15. They both found the end zone twice, though. So, like we talked about before, the sort of Javonte blow-up that could have turned him into the 1A, it did not. You can still play Javonte. He's still going to, right, because this team wants to run the football and they have such an efficient running back. You can still play him. It's just you are hoping that he is hyper-efficient, as he has been, on his 15 or so touches. He got there this week. You might get burned doing it sometimes in the future. And the passing game, there's not much to write home about because they really weren't forced to pass the ball much.
Yeah. And I hate doing it, but, you know, late swaps and that type of stuff. You can also play Melvin Gordon.
I think when I wrote them up, I think you should be playing Melvin Gordon over Javonte. It's a very clear still 60-40 split. And I love Javonte, right? But we typically want to be taking the touches. And Melvin Gordon has been playing okay this year, and he played good in this game. He's not a complete dud. Like, I think there's a talent discrepancy between Tony Pollard and Zeke. It seems pretty big at this point. At least with Melvin Gordon, you're not saying he is completely dusted. He still is a very serviceable back. He can still catch passes. I think you're still, I'm personally going to, I at least wrote this up, I'm probably still ranking Melvin Gordon based on the touches ahead of Javonte.
I think that would definitely make sense if the matchup's really easy, or, you know, if you expect touchdown equity out of the backfield. But I think in most weeks, I'd rather play Javonte because you're probably betting on big plays in the offense, since it's not an offense that's supporting a ton of production. Teddy Bridgewater here only had 179 passing yards. You know, you're playing the Lions, and it's a little disappointing that they couldn't put up more through the air. I had noted that Cortland Sutton was in a pretty good spot here because you can pass deep on the Lions, allowing the second highest rate of 15 plus yard receptions this season. Cortland Sutton goes 1 for 9. So do we just give up on Cortland Sutton? Is he not a thing anymore?
It doesn't seem like he's a thing anymore. I checked, the last blurb we had on him was that entering this week, he had an 11% target share in Jerry Jeudy games. He had an 8% target share in this game. So we are headed in the wrong direction on a team that isn't running the ball really well. I don't think, given how well their defense is playing, that, you know, obviously versus the Lions, you get to run the ball, but they still want to run the football even in closer games. And he's clearly not the number one receiver on his team. It's a very distant two at best. And then you have really good tight ends to compete with as well. So, like, wide receiver five, maybe? Like, I think he has in his past mm-hmm. five games, it's like 8 for 79, 8 for 89, something like that. I think it's 8 for 79, if I remember the numbers correctly. Those five games collectively. That's like a decent, that's a pretty good stat line if it's in one individual game. It's not that good, though. He didn't even score a touchdown, and it's over five games. So, yeah, you're definitely not playing him. I don't even think you're really rostering him. Like, he's very Allen Robinson-y in that way where, like, you're just holding on to him because you like him and you have fond memories, but nothing about his production in recent weeks, a month or two, really says you should be playing him at all. And at that point, why are you even holding him?
I think that's an interesting comparison, the Allen Robinson stuff, from, like, the emotional standpoint of, I can't be dropping this guy, but you should be at this point with both players, really. Let's talk about the Lions. And, like, I don't know how the policy works here, but it feels like you should get, like, an extra vacation day or two having a day where you cover the Jets and the Lions in the same shift.
I feel that.
Thank you for your service. let's talk about the Lions. I don't really know what there's talk about. Craig Reynolds, I guess, is a thing. 83 yards on the ground.
He looks spry, admittedly. Broke some long runs. I got to be honest. I know nothing about Craig Reynolds. I saw Schefter tweet in the morning that, I know he is like a practice squad bounce around between teams player, because I recognize him from, like, team preseason type of stuff. Outside of that, though, I don't know where he went to college. And the player who we thought might have a somewhat meaningful role, sort of in that, like, Austin Walters, like, if I can get 8 touches and he goes for 40 yards, I'd be happy, because at this point, all of my running backs are hurt, was Godwin Igwebuke, if I'm saying his name right. Unsurprisingly, the Lions chose not to give former XFL safety the lead back duties, and they gave to Craig Reynolds instead. No value in the backfield, regardless of if we get some sort of clarity that Craig Reynolds is the guy going forward, like, it doesn't really matter to me. He's still splitting a horrid team's touches, and he wasn't heavily targeted or anything. They didn't seem to have a clear passing downs back, or at least one that they're willing to target. So no, who cares about the backfield? Not playing any of them. And in terms of the pass catchers, Monroe St. Brown looks good. We could talk about that. He seems good. I'd like to not talk about the backfield anymore.
Yeah, let's talk about Monroe St. Brown. He had 12 targets, going 8 for 73.
Yeah, I mean, he's clearly, this game was different than last week. Last week, he also had 12 targets. I believe he caught 10 of them, was with TJ Hawkinson, and then he suffered a hand injury, didn't play this week. This one is probably easier for him to draw targets, but also the fact that he's not dreadfully inefficient when getting those targets on a team that's not efficient. Like, the fact that he's able to both draw the targets and then come down with them and produce some amount of yardage, he's not going to be hyper efficient, but the fact that he's the focal point of a bad passing attack, he's really the only player you're truly concerned about. And he still gets there. I think that's definitely worth something, especially when you think about looking forward. If they do get a good quarterback in the next year, maybe it doesn't happen for another year after that, but if they get a quarterback upgrade, he can draw a lot of targets. If the offense efficiency turns around again, that's not this year, very clearly not happening this year. But I think if you want to take it to like a dynasty context, players who draw targets at a young age probably continue to do so. So he's a perfectly fine, like, wide receiver 3-4 PPR option going forward, but he is like a kind of intriguing long-term outlook player.
Yeah, I agree. And, it took him a little while to get going, but he was kind of a buzzy in dynasty drafts in this offseason because of this was the thesis of the play, that he was going to be the slot receiver for Goff. And it seems like, that's something we can count on. That's one thing that I like about, these target totals of the last few weeks, is that we expect Goff to be targeting a slot receiver a lot, and we're finally seeing it.
Yeah, absolutely. Outside of that, I mean, Khalif Raymond found the end zone. It's really short, like, swing pass he took. Wasn't anything I think that's, like, I don't want to say repeatable. He's fine. It's perfectly fine. But this team, they got shut out in the second half. It was a pretty lackluster performance. They didn't have it didn't seem like they had a very specific tight end who they wanted to go to. It was supposed to be a cheap Brock Wright. He's 3 for 20. I think Amon-Ra St. Brown is looking at Josh Reynolds getting five targets. He went 3 for 52. Also not something you could bank on. If you can pull a lot of targets consistently in an offense, you're worth a PPR flyer. Outside of that, there's no non-Hawkinson tight end you're playing. There's no receivers you're playing until Jamal Williams or Swift, but Swift doesn't look that likely. Until one of those guys returns, you're not playing any of the running backs.
Yep. All right. God's Warcheck. Thanks so much.
Of course.
With Spring Black Friday deals at the Home Depot, you can give your lawn or garden beds a pop of color and protection. Right now, get a special buy on Scott's Earth Grow Mulch, 5 bags for just $10. Help your soil retain moisture longer with color that lasts up to 12 months. Shop Spring Black Friday deals for a special buy on Scott's Earth Grow Mulch, 5 bags for just $10 at the Home Depot. How doers get more done. Color selection varies by store. Limit 60 bags per customer while supplies last.
Dietz and Watson's been making meats and cheeses the right way since forever. What's that mean? It means never cutting corners, ever. It means cooking, not processing. It means our Virginia brand ham that's cooked to perfection, then twice baked to layer the flavors. It takes more time, but you can taste the difference. We come to work every day to do it the right way, even if it's the hard way. Because if it's not right for us, it's not right for you. Dietz and Watson, it's a family thing since 1939.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Give the gift of NBC Sports Edge Plus this holiday season. Get 15% off annual subscriptions when you use the code HOLIDAY15 at checkout. This offer turns to coal on December 31st, so visit NBCSportsEdge.com/EdgePlus today. We're headed down the back stretch of the NFL season, and the NBC Sports Predictor app powered by PointsBet has you covered with Sunday Night 7. We're giving you a shot to win $1 million every Sunday night throughout the rest of the NFL season. It's free and easy to play. So predict what will happen between the Saints and Bucks for a chance to win. Download today from your app store or visit NBCSports.com/predictor. The Titans shut out the Jaguars 20-0. The Jaguars have now scored 7 points in their last 8 quarters. They now have 7 straight games with under 20 points. Jack Miller, the Jaguars were not competitive today.
They were not, and that's becoming something of a trend with them. Offensively, I mean, the 0 point speaks for itself, but they were just really brutal. Trevor Lawrence had a season-high 4 interceptions today. They had 8 team rushing yards. James Robinson led the way, I guess I'll say, with 6 carries for 4 yards. So all around, just not a great offensive performance from them.
Yeah, you mentioned 4 interceptions from Lawrence. He did throw for 221 yards, which isn't a lot, but it is actually like more than maybe I would have thought, given the fact that they scored 0 points. Marvin Jones was the leading receiver here with 70 yards. Laquon Treadwell just behind with 68. 4 receptions for Treadwell on 6 targets. And Marvin Jones had 6 receptions on 7 targets. Laviska Shenault third with 4 receptions for 34 yards on 7 targets. James O'Shaughnessy came in with 4 for 21 on 6 targets. So there was like a decent amount of like kind of, I don't know, mediocre to poor PPR production, I suppose, here. But what did you see from the receivers?
Yeah, I mean, Lawrence did have 221 yards, but he needed 40 pass attempts to get there. So on an efficiency basis, it still wasn't great. Marvin Jones was the bright spot. He had 70 yards, and then he had another 30-ish, I think it was 31-yard completion that was negated by offsetting penalties. So he could have had a triple-digit yardage day if that had stood. Shenault had a couple of nice early plays, a couple of third-down conversions, but he was actually the one who was at fault for Trevor's first pick because it hit him in the hands and then went right in the arms of a Titans player. And then Treadwell was mostly quiet, but he did have a 41-yarder in the second half at some point. So besides Marvin Jones, really just kind of a quiet day for all of the weapons.
On the Titans side, Let's start with the backfield because, you know, Jeremy McNichols came back for this game and he had 8 carries for 16 yards, but Dontrell Hilliard had had a bigger role while McNichols was out. He was still involved with 6 carries for 13 yards. Deontay Foreman led the way, though, with 13 carries for 47 yards, and he does score a touchdown. But also, they're playing the Jaguars, literally shutting them out. So how much can we take away from the carry counts, from the box score? What was your read on the split here for the running backs?
Yeah, so Foreman was the primary guy for most of the game, I would say. There was a stretch where it was kind of weird. He was on the sideline, he had his helmet on, he was standing up, but he just didn't play for a couple of series. But besides that, he was the lead guy. And then McNichols got snaps here and there throughout the game, but most of his touches, you mentioned he had the 8 carries, and most of those came kind of in garbage time mop-up duty. So I would say Foreman was the lead guy, except for a couple of series where, for whatever reason, it was Dontrell Hilliard getting all the snaps. And then McNichols played snaps here and there throughout the game, especially on the passing downs, but most of his touches came when the game was already salted away.
And then Tannehill only throws for 191 yards here, 191, but does score a touchdown on the ground, rushes 4 times for 29 yards, excuse me. So there's just not that much receiving production here to go around, to the point that Jeff Swaim actually led all receivers with 45 yards.
Yeah, I mean, 191 yards. He didn't need to do a whole lot to beat the Jaguars. And Julio Jones was back, but he did not play a full allotment of snaps. I think Nick Westbrook was the guy who led the Titans receivers in snaps. I don't know if Julio was on a snap count maybe in his first game back from the hamstring injury, or if they're just trying to protect him for the playoffs. But he was not getting every snap as maybe some would have expected going into the game. So Tannehill really kind of had his work cut out for him with the weapons he had at his disposal. And then the Jaguars actually generated pretty decent pressure throughout the game. So, you know, Tannehill did what he needed to. He salvaged his fantasy day with a 5-yard rushing touchdown. But for the most part, I would just say not a whole lot to take away for him.
All right. Jack Miller, thanks so much.
Yeah, for sure.
The Cowboys defeated Washington 27-20 in a game where Amari Cooper scored his first touchdown since October 31st against the Vikings. John Daigle, the Cowboys looked like they were going to completely run away with this one, but it got kind of close at the end.
Mind you, it wasn't for the offense either. This is another week of consecutive weeks that Cowboys offense has looked like complete trash, Dak included. You would think if a stranger, let's say they sat down to watch this game, football in general, for the first time ever, you would think they would assume the point of the game is to throw the ball to the other team, because that's all Dak and Heineke were doing, forcing errant throws, indecisiveness, making poor decisions throughout. But the Cowboys did do enough, in particular on defense, to build a 24-0 first half lead, and that's really where it got put away. Cowboys defense in general held Washington at 29 yards on 26 plays in the first half, as Washington also went 0 for 6 on third down and held Heineke to 19 passing yards, sacked twice for a net minus 26. It was an absolutely dreadful performance by Washington's offense, and I don't even know it's so much to pin on Heineke as it is Cowboys getting healthy all of a sudden. This was Neville Gallimore, arguably Dallas's best interior pass rusher, his first game of the year, off injured reserve. Randy Gregory, off injured reserve. DeMarcus Lawrence, totally healthy. Micah Parsons now, not only defensive rookie of the year, we're talking he should be neck and neck with Myles Garrett for defensive player of the year. There were plays in this game where, if you watch the tape, and don't, because this game is awful, where a pass got batted up, let's say Cam Sims 20 yards downfield, and Micah Parsons is down there around like Jordan Lewis, and I'm like, why the hell is Micah Parsons 20 yards downfield? Because that's what he does. He's not only an elite pass rusher, but he can track wide receivers with the same foot speed as them. It's wild. And so, like, those guys I just mentioned, they're literally just the monstars in Cowboys jerseys. They're freak athletes who are now fully healthy, and that's how this team it strong and coast into the postseason. It's not this offense, and they're still figuring it out. Right now, it's the defense and the pass rush in particular that's carrying them, and it's a pass rush that no one should want to face when they're all at full health, since they're just a bunch of freak athletes who move tackles and guards out of the way. Zeke Elliott also in this game, getting nearly every touch in the first half in place of Tony Pollard. And Prescott did miss him on a couple wheel routes on a couple end zone targets here. But again, he's basically less touches Saquon Barkley at this point, where you're hoping for a touchdown because he offers no ceiling, since he's still very clearly limping in every game, even coming off for a few possessions in this game to readjust his knee brace and then limping back out into the field. That's why you see a team-high 13 carries from Corey Clement. But also Zeke was trying to rest in the second half before things got a little out of hand, as you mentioned. Taylor Heinicke knocked out of the game due to Neville Gallimore just moving Washington center out of the way, and now suddenly they're on their fourth center because their third center in this game got carted off the field. Heinicke also knocked out of the game. Kyle Allen comes in, and they do get a touchdown there, but overall it was pretty much just put away at the end, all because of the defense and Washington having their second string offense essentially out there to close the game.
You mentioned the defense. Through the first half, the Cowboys had allowed 0 points, 29 yards. They had allowed 29 yards and a half, two turnovers in the first half. Things kind of got back. The game tightened up in the second half, but Dak threw a pick six, which, you know, certainly contributed to that. I wanted to ask you, because, you know, I was covering another game, but I had Red Zone on another monitor, and it felt like every time I looked over and they're showing the Washington game that Taylor Heinicke was throwing into triple coverage. And I couldn't tell, like, am I just seeing the same replays, or is, like, how many times is this guy just throwing into, you know, just a field of Dallas defenders?
It was him and Dak, always a field of defenders, even Dak's pick six. Now, I think it was because he could not see over the DE's head, and thus he didn't see the linebacker right in the middle, because Dalton Schultz was basically running wide open. Had Dak thrown a little more to his right, he would have hit him. Nonetheless, like, he did not see the linebacker, and Cole Holcomb then picked it off and just ran free into the end zone. But it was like that from both sides. This was a terrible offensive game. Even go to Antonio Gibson, who was not explosive on his 10 carries, and basically taken out of the game because the offense was so poor, again, like we mentioned in the first half. But then even the Washington makes it after a Taylor Heinicke 40-yard touchdown. Cowboys then run four plays, punt the ball. Washington gets it back. Two plays later on that drive, Gibson coughs up his fourth lost fumble of the year, sixth fumble on the season, and then basically gets benched. The game's out of hand at this point, so he gets benched then. But even when they started coming back with Kyle Allen, that's why I mentioned second-string offense, because they instead just put Jonathan Williams, who I didn't even realize was on the roster, to be honest. They instead just put Jonathan Williams on the field instead of Antonio Gibson. And that's why you see Williams have two 10-plus yard gains in the fourth quarter over Gibson, because they literally just stuck with Kyle Allen and Jonathan Williams and Cam Sims, who was replacing Terry McLaurin, since McLaurin suffered a concussion in the third quarter. And not that he was, like, emerging or exploding beyond that. This is actually his first career game without a single catch in the NFL, because he just wasn't separating and they couldn't get him the ball, since Heinicke was under duress every single drop back.
Let's talk about Heinicke, because he exited with injury. What did you see out of Kyle Allen? Like, and do we know if we're going to potentially not have Taylor Heinicke next week and we might have an Allen start?
Adam Schefter said it's promising. It looks like Heinicke will be good to go against the Eagles. At this point, though, we know what Heinicke is, and we know what Kyle Allen is. They're not going to shock the world. They're not going to shock us. There will be a handful of plays. Even Heineke's 40-yard touchdown on this one, a Romo-like backspin move out of Micah Parsons, just about to crash onto him, and then scrambles to his left, and Heinicke throws it deep and finds Cam Sims, who has to essentially knee tap to get in. It was an amazing catch. But it's little dazzling plays like that he makes every once in a while. Otherwise, the wheels can also fall completely off, and that's basically what happened in this game. Kyle Allen had a big scramble in the fourth quarter when he was in. But also, he's the one who coughed up the fumble to give the Cowboys back the final possession for Dak to eventually just sneak it on third down, pick up the first down, and then just allow them to kneel at the clock and get the hell out of there with a and escape with a win. But yeah, that's nothing special from either quarterback. I know we're going to monitor it as if we monitor like Daniel Jones and Mike Glennon thinking it actually matters. It doesn't matter. Yeah. They're all the same guy.
That's fair. The receivers here for Dallas, Lamb, Gallup, and Cooper all had at least 50 yards, but Lamb led the way with 61 yards. So not a ton of production, kind of split pretty evenly among the three guys. Lamb led with 10 targets, Gallup had 9, Cooper had 7, but Cooper is the one who got in the end zone. Any thoughts on the Dallas Cowboys receivers?
Schultz has seemed to have fallen by the wayside the last 2 weeks with all three available. Cooper was limited against the Saints, no longer limited in this game. Nonetheless, Schultz has now totaled 8 targets the past 2 weeks. And although Cooper was the one to score a touchdown, CeeDee Lamb, as you said, still led the team with 10 targets, has 23 targets the last two games. And Gallup now has at least 8 targets in 5 consecutive games. Yes, Cooper and Lamb have been in and out of lineup in that span. But overall, it seems like all of them are sticking around in place of Schultz, which is what I think we expected anyhow. Also, another game in which, like last week, week 13, the Cowboys had the 5th highest pass play rate from neutral game script. And maybe that was because of a more pass-heavy attack against a team they know they can't run on the Saints. Perhaps that was the case again. But when we look at their final numbers, whenever they check in at Pro Football Focus, we will see Cowboys had 8 dropbacks on their 11 on their first 11 plays, and then also were probably yet again a heavy passing team in neutral game script. And I wonder if that was just because of Washington, or is that what this team is going to be, knowing Zeke is not healthy and knowing all three receivers are healthy instead? So just something to monitor, because that's how all three of these guys survive weekly.
Let's move to the second game you had, where the Chargers defeated the Giants 37-21. Justin Herbert is now the second quarterback ever, Dan Marino being the other one, who has 60-plus total touchdown passes in their first two seasons.
And he was awesome yet again. Another game where they stayed attacking downfield, although it is easier against the Giants, and one genuinely that was put away and out of hand in the first half. Let's just start with the Giants' first drive. They faced 4th and 2 from midfield, and Judge, who has been asked by the media about his conservative play calling and that has even told people, responded, that punting is a type of aggressiveness, decided to, of course, punt in this situation on 4th and 2. And he even said that Riley Dixon was the reason why, like, he leans on his punter. And of course, the punter, Riley, punted into the end zone on that one situation. So it wasn't even, he didn't even save the drive or win field position. He just punted and they took it from the 20 from there. Giants trailed 24-7 at the half. They trailed 37-7 with 4:30 remaining. And then Glennon and Saquon Barkley garbage timed their way to make the score look more respectable, even though this was not a no contest from the very beginning. And now the Giants are 19-42 under Dave Gettleman and 10-19 under Joe Judge. They're a complete joke. That's what's happening right now. Sterling Shepard, his one catch, it didn't come until the middle of the third quarter when it didn't matter anymore. So it's just hard for anyone, any other pass catchers, to survive with Mike Glennon under center and just this offense as a whole. You can keep on starting Barkley. And generally, like, I know we start with Herbert here, but this is how easily you knock the Giants. Like I mentioned earlier, Zeke is less touch Barkley. Barkley is just Barkley. He gets all the touches, and that's great. But you better hope he rattles off an explosive touchdown. Otherwise, he's just useless. Just your touch-based guy that you're starting because everyone else in the league is injured. In this case, in garbage time, he did. He got matched out wide on the boundary with a cornerback and absolutely dusted him. And Glennon found him for a 30-yard touchdown. So he did get there in this one. But it's a week-to-week risky game we're playing here with Barkley.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, just because the offense is so bad. I've been kind of defending Barkley recently against the charges that he's done, you know, and What are your thoughts on kind of does Barkley look still like Barkley to you, or are you actually kind of worried about, you know, him maybe not being the same type of talent?
Oh, I don't know if he's done. Next year can be a different conversation. This year, though, he still looks slightly limited. And also, remember, this is what he was at Penn State as well. Now he would rattle off more explosive plays, but he's always just been a boomer bust type running back anyways, who likely will get another big contract, so it doesn't matter at all. Nonetheless, though, I think he is still slightly limited, but he got this one. And that touchdown catch, he did separate like quite heavily. There was a lot of distance there. So perhaps he is still explosive, but he got there. He's a touch-based low-end RB1 for the rest of the year, and there are no arguments for that.
Kyle Rudolph was ripping off Yak in this game, so it was pretty weird for the receiving totals here. Kenny Golladay only had 2 for 15 on 8 targets. You mentioned Shepard. It just seems like kind of a disaster, but it's a Mike Glennon-led passing offense. So unless you have anything else on that, we can talk about the Chargers, because Herbert was without Keenan Allen here, and he still had quite a nice day. Only 275 yards passing, but 3 touchdowns. He hit Guyton deep for a 59-yarder. Josh Palmer got in the end zone. Mike Williams didn't have the big day that, you know, we were kind of hoping he would, but that production went to the other two wide receivers instead.
No role change for Mike Williams. No pelting him with targets. Instead, it was just whoever's open gets the ball. And in this case, they slid Josh Palmer directly into the slot as Keenan Allen's de facto replacement. Even mentioned post-game, Staley did, that they just view Palmer's route running and run blocking similar to Keenan Allen's. And so that's why he's the most logical fit there. And that still allows Jalen Guyton to go deep on the boundary. And that's exactly what happened. Even Guyton's touchdown, Palmer scored first, actually. And so we thought, okay, this is the replacement. But then Guyton's touchdown, he does what he does. He just goes open, he gets deep, and Herbert sailed a ball that accumulated 68 air yards into a touchdown for Guyton. An unbelievable throw that he got a hit on. He got a hit on, and the ball sailed literally 68 air yards. So just incredible. Good to see them stay in aggressive downfield attack. Now we step back and go back to Guyton as their third receiver, since this team has a very important and short turnaround on Thursday night against the Chiefs. Also why you see numbers padded for everyone behind Austin Ekeler, because Ekeler suffered an ankle injury in the third quarter. But Staley said after the game, he thinks he could have come back. Remember, this game was out of hand, and with the short turnaround against the Chiefs on Thursday, a must-win game essentially, there's no need to bring him back. So we're going to get Keenan Allen back for that game most likely. We'll have Austin Ekeler back for that game, and so the Chargers will be at full health again.
Yeah, and as you say that, I wonder if the note that I read at the top was actually that each of Herbert and Marino have had 60 plus yard touchdown passes. So we'll have to make sure.
Yeah. Herbert,
check that before repeating it at a point.
I believe Herbert is the first quarterback ever. So this makes sense. He's the first player ever to have at least 30 touchdowns in his first two seasons, which is crazy to think of considering how he was viewed coming out of Oregon. And of course we can just look back at his OC and say, oh, well, like they didn't use him properly. That's fine. But then also think that he was only on the field last year. It's going to be literally one of the greatest what-ifs ever. Like, what if the Chargers doctor didn't screw up that needle into Tyrod Taylor's lung? What happens with Justin Herbert? But here we are, nonetheless, setting records with him.
We're watching Davis Mills this year, so I think we would have gotten Herbert eventually last year. but yeah, it is. We definitely got him a little earlier because of the Chargers doctor. Let's talk the backfield here. Austin Ekeler got banged up in this game, right?
Yeah, the ankle injury in the third quarter. Again, we believe he's going to play. He pretty much got held out because they knew they had to turn around Thursday in a must-win game. And if Eckler's out, we've had this talk. I've had this talk on the waiver wire. We've had this talk on our waiver wire show together. I don't think there's a direct replacement, honestly. It'd be three guys, Larry Roundtree, Josh Kelly, and Justin Jackson. And probably Roundtree or Kelly will get goal line touches, but nonetheless, I think they will all be involved. So there's no direct contingency option to grab if Ekeler were out. But such a big game, I would bet on Ekeler being ready to go.
That makes sense. I mean, just very logical for them to hold him out in this big win. But I think that'll do it. John Daigle, thanks so much. All right, that'll do it for Week 14's recap pod. Thanks so much for listening. I know we're getting down to the tail end of the NFL season here. I hope everything is going great for your fantasy leagues. Hope you're in the playoffs. Hope you take down a championship this year. Make sure to check us out next week as we recap Week 15.
With Spring Black Friday deals at the Home Depot, you can give your lawn or garden beds a pop of color and protection. Right now, get a special buy on Scott's Earth Grow Mulch, 5 bags for just $10. Help your soil retain moisture longer with color that lasts up to 12 months. Shop Spring Black Friday deals for a special buy on Scott's Earth Grow Mulch 5 bags for just $10 at the Home Depot. How doers get more done. Color selection varies by store. Limit 60 bags per customer while supplies last.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.